Good morning. Final case on our court's oral calendar this morning is State v. Carlson. We're ready for arguments. Counsel should be sure to state his name for the record before each leg of your argument, so we have a record of who is appearing on our oral recording. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Sean Smallwood, and I'm here today as a Special Assistant State Public Defender representing Mr. Sage Carlson in this appeal, who is also here with us in the gallery. As this court has recognized, searches without a warrant are per se unreasonable unless one of the well-delineated exceptions to the warrant requirement applies. Not only that, but as the Minnesota courts have recently recognized, the odor of marijuana alone usually is insufficient to support probable cause under the automobile exception. Despite this, when Mr. Carlson was pulled over for an ordinary traffic violation, the district court erroneously found that the officer had both a reasonable suspicion in order to expand the traffic stop, but also probable cause in order to search Mr. Carlson's vehicle under the automobile exception. This decision was wrong both as a matter of law and as a matter of fact. Specifically as to reasonable suspicion, the district court erred in two ways. First, it relied on facts that are not clearly established within the record. And second, as a matter of law, the odor of marijuana cannot and should not be able to support reasonable suspicion to expand an ordinary traffic stop.
What do you do with the Askaruth case about asking somebody to get out of the car is not an expansion of the stop?
Our reading of Askaruth is that that is a permissive expansion. It doesn't mean that there's a bright line rule that an officer can always expand a traffic stop by asking the individual out of the vehicle.
Hasn't the United States Supreme Court said otherwise?
Yes, that case is Pennsylvania versus Mims. But if you look at some of the Minnesota case law around this, there is a different standard under the Minnesota Constitution whenever it comes to searches and seizures as it relates not only to probable cause determinations, but specifically as to reasonable suspicion as well.
What was the officer's testimony regarding when he first smelled the marijuana?
He smelled marijuana as he was approaching the vehicle.
So before he asked your client to get out of the car?
Yes, Your Honor.
And are you saying that under Minnesota's application of MIMS, an officer isn't allowed to ask a driver to get out of the car after observing speeding and smelling marijuana from outside of the car?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is our principal argument here. And while we understand that that would be a departure potentially from Askaruth as well as some of the other court's opinions, we think that this is warranted at least for a number of reasons.
Why is that?
So three principal reasons are warrant departure here. The first being that possession of marijuana is not always a crime, which Torgerson discussed explicitly, and they discussed it at length in its opinion from 169 to 170. The second being that courts in other states have held similarly. Courts in states where marijuana has been decriminalized to a certain extent, similar to how Minnesota has decriminalized marijuana. And those two cases are from Oregon as well as Massachusetts.
And this is a big picture question because I recognize that the law wasn't in effect at the time of this stop, but Minnesota still criminalizes the use of marijuana in any motor vehicle on a street or roadway.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So if we made an exception here today, aren't we going to run against a problem as we start to see new offenses that come in that say, well, after August 1st, 2023, it still remains a crime to use marijuana in a car? And wouldn't an officer have reason to suspect a violation of that misdemeanor law if he observes a speeding vehicle, approaches the vehicle, and smells marijuana from outside the vehicle?
I think this court can certainly make a limited ruling as to that particular determination. And the facts of this case, I think, lend itself really well to that particular ruling in the sense that there was not a smell of burnt marijuana, indicating that there was an active use of marijuana while the appellate was using the vehicle.
What was the testimony regarding the smell?
It just said that there was an odor of marijuana, completely nondescript. And that is similar to the cases in Oregon as well as in Massachusetts where there wasn't a smell of burnt marijuana. The smell was of unburnt marijuana. And certainly I can recognize that it might seem like we're splitting hairs here whenever we're trying to tell an officer what to do as a part of their duty.
Well, just from a perspective of reasonableness and what a reasonable person might think or assume, I mean, one might assume that if you smell marijuana from outside of a car, it's either because it's burnt or burning marijuana and the smoke would drift out, or you've got a whole lot of unburnt marijuana in the car. Neither assumption necessarily helps your client.
I definitely would reject the assumption necessarily that there has to be a large amount of marijuana in order for there to be a particular smell. But I also would rely on the officer's training in order to determine whether or not there was burnt or unburnt marijuana. And the officer here in their probable cause packet, which is the only testimony, the only record that we have to go off of, the officer doesn't provide any type of clear description as to what that actually smelled like.
When did the officer observe or become aware of the vape pen?
The officer became aware of the vape pen whenever the officer asked Mr. Carlson out of the vehicle and subsequently questioned him.
Okay, so he saw it, or did
no, he did not
just
see
hand it over?
The client provided the CBD pen. And so this actually leads into...
So if assuming without deciding that it was okay to ask him out of the car under our case law as it currently exists without modifying it for the purposes of this case... Before the officer decided to search the car, he observed speeding, smelled marijuana. Your client provided a device commonly used to ingest marijuana. And at that point, had your client, you know, made the statements about, I couldn't have been speeding, I wasn't speeding. I know that there was some reliance on his statements to show that he was not accurately perceiving his circumstances.
Yes, that's correct. So as the record states, the officer pulled him over for speeding. Mr. Carlson was stating that he couldn't have been speeding, that there was a potentially misperception of his speed, which I think is common for a speeding traffic violation to begin with. But then as the officer asked Mr. Carlson about the odor of marijuana, Mr. Carlson offers the CBD pen, which could also be used as a vape pen. It could be used to not ingest marijuana. And it might be something that he can't legally purchase, as the district court found. But it's not something that he may not legally possess, potentially, as a user of tobacco or potentially as a medical cannabis user. And so for those reasons, we think that even with the CBD pen plus his age, those are the facts in which this court should make its determination on. The misperception of his speed, I think, is a red herring in this particular case because it seems to conflate the speeding violation, which was the initial purpose of the stop. Now, in order for the officer to have a reasonable suspicion or even probable cause further, they need to have another independent basis as to why that particular person might be using marijuana in a criminally illegal manner. Misperception of speed doesn't necessarily add anything to the analysis other than the fact that it was speeding at the inception.
Well, as I understand the district court's order, it adds to the analysis in that it is a crime to operate a motor vehicle while under the influence of marijuana, and perhaps if you are not accurately describing your conduct that was just observed, that might indicate that you are impaired.
Potentially, Your Honor, but I would point to this court's case in Robinson in which that individual was speeding. That individual was also suspected of marijuana, but the court said that that person was not impaired even with the speeding violation. And so I think that even
if... Is that a precedential decision?
It's not precedential, but it's certainly persuasive in the sense that the facts are closely aligned here, the minor difference being that Mr. Carlson was 19 at the time of the stop. And there's no indication that Mr. Robinson was under the age of 21 at the time of that particular stop. And I see that we're moving into specifically the probable cause determination, which I think is really at the crux of the argument. So even if this court decides that there was reasonable suspicion, they can also reverse as to probable cause, because as Torgerson specifically identified, the standard whenever it comes to the odor of marijuana, which again is the officer's only stated reason in this particular case as to why he decided to go into the vehicle and search the vehicle, that the officer had to be able to make a determination that the odor of marijuana was indicating that marijuana was being used in a criminally illegal manner. And there's no specific fact-finding done by the district court or in the probable cause packet that lends itself to say that Mr. Carlson was potentially using marijuana at the time of the stop or was using it in a criminally illegal manner.
If we had a fact-finding that the officer smelled the odor of burnt or burning marijuana, would the circumstances be different in your view?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the finding would have been different there because then it would indicate recent use of marijuana. But again, even if the court were to find that there was burnt marijuana, we think that the officer still needs to be able to do more here in order to substantiate its probable cause determination. And so, again, because the officer's only stated reason is the odor of marijuana, no indication of as to strength or recent usage, the officer could have done one more thing here and it would have been able to tip the scales against my client.
We review the record de novo. We review the district court's decision de novo. We look at the record. Isn't it true that we try to determine whether an objectively reasonable officer would see probable cause? So, I mean, are we limited by this officer's statement of only one reason?
I do believe that we're limited to the officer's statement here, and the support that I would find for that is in the decision with Cripps. Specifically where the officer had no other statement that he was going into the vehicle for anything other than a specific, I don't recall the exact fact there, but it was based on the officer's statement that they found that there was no probable cause in order to enter the vehicle. Another case that I would rely on, again, a non-precedential case but certainly persuasive, is this court's decision in Austin, where, again, the officer in testimony stated that the officer's only reason for going into the vehicle was because of the odor of marijuana. Now, granted, we do not have testimony specifically from the officer. We don't have cross-examination evidence here either. But what I will say is that if we use the probable cause packet as a proxy for testimony from the officer, which the state doesn't refute, we would see that the officer's only stated reason is because of the odor of marijuana, which is precluded by the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Torgerson and has been precluded by this court in subsequent cases in Austin as well as Robinson. Finally, I do want to quickly address respondents' request to apply the good faith exception as to this case. It's our understanding that the respondent's argument here is that because this stop happened before Torgerson and because the officer might have had a reasonable understanding of the law at that time to be able to go into the vehicle because of the odor of marijuana alone, that is reason enough in order to save the state's position here. But we would point out first that this was not raised in the district court. And even the cases that respondent provides as support for its position are not clearly on point and do not actually tip the scales in favor of applying the Lindquist exception here. Specifically, respondent talks about the case in terms of Douglas. And Douglas specifically was discussing, that was one of the sole issues that was in front of this court at that time, whether or not the Lindquist exception should apply. And the state applied that as a part of its reasoning in the district court. The second reason that I would point to is that Robinson is actually more on point for this particular argument, because Robinson considered the same argument on appeal. It was not the sole issue before this court at that time, and the state did not raise that argument in the district court. Now, I will acknowledge the fact that respondents have filed a letter brief providing supplemental authority just a couple of days ago, and I don't have the case name off the top of my head, but that case, as I read it, was talking specifically about a different kind of exception. It wasn't necessarily talking about the Lindquist exception, but respondent relies on it in order to substantiate that they're allowed to make our alternative arguments as to why this court can affirm that particular decision. And we don't seek to ask this court to not consider alternative arguments in those situations, but we do think that that argument is not properly before this court right now, as because that case is distinguishable, and that case was actually talking about an argument that was raised in the district court. So if you look at that particular case, respondent provides an alternative argument, but if you look further down into the case itself, it talks about how the argument provided by respondent as an alternative argument was actually just a recapitulation of an argument that they had made in the district court, and it was based on evidentiary rules. We don't think that that's applicable here, and we would again ask this court to apply the same reasoning that it had in Douglas, as the same reason that it had as in Robinson, but also to look specifically at Torgerson, which also talks about the Lindquist exception and says that this wasn't raised in the district court either as to reasons why this court should decline to do so here. So
I'd like to go back to your argument that the officer here had only one stated reason. I see you've argued that in page 18 of your brief and so on. Is that a linchpin of your argument? In other words, if we were to disagree on that point, that we may consider other reasons that appear from the record and would appear to a objectively reasonable officer, then, I mean, do you have a backup or alternative argument to say that even still, even considering the other reasons, there's still a lack of probable cause?
Yes, we would point to, I believe it's three reasons. The first being that the district court committed clear error by relying on facts that weren't in the record, specifically that the stop occurred at night, which makes the factual determination here reversible by this court.
And the state, I think, has conceded that and taken it out of the analysis, essentially.
Yes, and also as to impaired driving, and that was addressed earlier with Judge Larkin. The third reason that I would really point to here is... Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Three reasons why, even if we consider all of the apparent facts in the record, all the reasons identified by the district court and the state, why you still win.
Yes, even if you take the facts that are in the record and if you affirm the facts that he was 19, that he had a CBD pin, those two reasons are not enough under, and they shouldn't be enough in order to support reasonable suspicion here or probable cause, because being 19 and having a CBD pin does not mean that you are using marijuana in a criminally illegal manner, or it doesn't give rise to a reasonable suspicion that a crime has occurred. And so for those reasons, we ask the court to reverse, and I will be back on rebuttal.
Thank you. For the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Ragatz. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent. Case law says in a stop and search case, we should go through what happens step by step. There's four steps here, and there's 5 points I want to make about those steps. The first step is the stop, the seizure. This case is not like Dawson, where there was no valid basis for the stop or seizure. Everyone's agreed here this was a valid stop for speeding. So that's step one. He was going 52 and a 40. There's no dispute here that the initial stop was valid. So step two is getting him out of the car. Now, here's what Askaruth says, and I quote, "It is correct that a police officer may order a driver out of a lawfully stopped vehicle without an articulated reason," unquote. And then 5 years after Askaruth and Ortega, the court said, you can even get a passenger out of the car for no articulated reason. So that's clear Minnesota case law. It doesn't get any clearer than that. Appellant's asking you now to depart from that, but of course, you can't depart from that. It's binding Supreme Court precedent. Appellant can PFR and ask the Supreme Court to change the law and make it not a may, but in some circumstances can. But here, the law is clear. You may do this, not you may only if there's more than just speeding or something. So that's step number two.
Well, on step two, let me ask you, what do we do with the district court's finding? It's the addendum 8, that the officer expanded the traffic stop when he directed Mr. Carlson to step out of the vehicle. So the court made a finding that that was the expansion.
Well, the court stated the law wrong, essentially, because that's not what Askaruth says. It isn't a factual finding. It's a legal conclusion that this was an expansion of the stop, and that's just wrong under Askaruth. So you wouldn't defer to the judge on that because it's a legal question. There aren't any facts in dispute there. Everyone agrees the officer asked him out of the car. But clearly, under Askaruth, you can do that. So it gets a little more interesting with steps three and four. Although step three, not so much. Step three is basically whether the officer had reasonable articulable suspicion to expand not the length of the stop, but the scope of the stop by commenting on the smell of marijuana. He didn't even actually ask about the smell of marijuana. He just commented on it. But even if you look at this in like an interrogation situation, this is a comment that's likely to elicit a response. Even if you consider that a scope of the stop issue, reasonable articulable suspicion is not a high standard. And what we have here is the smell of marijuana. There's no case law that says you can't even ask about the smell of marijuana. The cases appellant relies on regarding smell of marijuana are probable cause cases. Reasonable articulable suspicion, obviously much less high a standard than probable cause. But you also here have the misperception of speeding. And I want to be clear, we're not relying on the speeding alone. Speeding may be common. Maybe misperception's common when you're going a couple miles over the speed limit. But he's going 30% over the speed limit. He's going 12 miles an hour over the speed limit in a 40. It's not even 12 in a 70 or something. So there's certainly reasonable suspicion here when he's adamant that he wasn't doing this, that maybe he's under the influence of marijuana. Maybe he's misperceiving things. And again, reasonable articulable suspicion just means he needs something more than a hunch. Well, it's not a hunch when you're relying on what he said, your radar gun, and the smell that is not disputed. This is not one of those cases where there's an argument, well, the officer couldn't really smell marijuana. He must have made that up later. No dispute here that there was the smell of marijuana. Reasonable articulable suspicion is a low, low standard. And the cases like Robinson that may involve speeding don't involve a misperception of speeding. Appellant doesn't cite any case where someone's adamant, I couldn't have been speeding, when the radar gun says you were and not just by a little bit. So reasonable articulable suspicion, not hard. That gets us to step four, whether there's probable cause. And at this point, we not only have the odor of marijuana.
Let me back you up real quick. Between step one and two, the officer had learned of the driver's age too, right? Got the
right.
So in your sort of analysis, that if and how for our purposes, learning the driver's age and having the smell of marijuana, putting the two and two together, he's not of age to have marijuana.
Right. Right. And that is also relevant here. If you look at the case law, it's discussed in Torvison. I think it's starts with an S. Sisavang or something is discussed in Torvison. These are cases that distinguish adult odor of alcohol situations from underage odor of alcohol situations. It's just different. I mean, even if he could have theoretically possessed a non-criminal amount of marijuana if he was 21, he wasn't 21 here. Also importantly, he couldn't have been legally sold the CBD pen. And that was one of the things I was going to get to on step four. And he said, I bought it in Hutchinson. He didn't say, oh, I don't know where this came from. I've had it forever. So that was another thing that went to probable cause, figuring out who illegally sold him this CBD pen. And the judge described the CBD pen as a marijuana delivery device. And it's listed in the police report that was the exhibit here as drug paraphernalia. So when you take the odor, the misperception of speeding, along with drug paraphernalia, there's no case that says that's enough, not enough for probable cause. I mean, probable cause is higher than reasonable articulable suspicion, but it's not even like a greater than 50% chance. That's what the case law says. It's certainly not a situation where you have to eliminate all other reasonable explanations. And I would point this court to the Chavez-Aguilar decision that's cited in an appellant brief, which points out that Torgerson recognizes the importance of drug paraphernalia by specifically noting the absence of drug paraphernalia in that case. So when you've got drug paraphernalia, you've got speeding and the misperception thereof and the odor of alcohol, you're beyond Torgerson. Torgerson says odor can factor in. Odor alone can't be enough. We're not just relying on odor here. And I think it is important that we remember this is an objective test. No case has ever said, well, it's only objective based on what the officer said, because then it would be subjective. The Cripps decision that appellant cites from, I think, 1995, basically it just indicates that the facts have to be known at the officer at the time. Even if the officer didn't list all the facts or say he was relying on the facts, as long as they're known at the time, you must be able to consider them. Otherwise, it's not an objective test.
What's the best case that says that?
Well, I'd cite you to any case that says it's an objective test, basically, because that's what objective means. I'm not aware of any case that has ever said, of all the facts known to the officer, we can only use the ones the officer said he was relying on or that the officer listed.
Well, we have case law that expressly says it's not a subjective determination. The officer's right. Subjective reasoning is not determinative.
Yes, there are numerous cases that say that. And so even if an officer says the wrong thing, as long as the facts are correct, that's what the objective test means. And similarly, appellant has criticized Judge Van Haan here and his reasoning. But the question here isn't whether Judge Van Haan's reasoning was impeccable. The question is, did he reach the right result? I don't think you've ever flipped a case and said, well, the judge reached the right result, but we don't like the way he explained it, so we're reversing. That's not what de novo review means, just like that's not what an objective test means. So the question here is, under the three key facts known by the officer at the time, smell of marijuana, drug paraphernalia, misperception of going well above the speed limit, is that enough for probable cause? And there's no case that even hints that it isn't. So those are the four steps, and I said I had 5 points. My fifth point is, even if you disagree with me on probable cause, you should still affirm under Dawson. because there was good faith here. And appellant's main argument is, well, you can't raise good faith now because he didn't raise it at the district court. But as I pointed out in the letter I filed on Monday, Gruding clearly says you can raise new arguments on appeal if you're the respondent and you don't rely on additional facts. And there's no claim there's additional facts here. This is just like Dawson in that sense. No case has overruled Gruning. Appellant relies on the Robinson case, but that case is interesting and problematic. I went back and looked at the briefs on that case. In that case, the appellant never argued that the state had forfeited a good faith argument. It just argued good faith shouldn't apply here. So the panel in that case found forfeiture just completely on its own. The state never had a chance to argue Gruning. The panel in that non-precedential case doesn't portend to overrule Gruning, which clearly applies. It cites Torgerson, but the problem in Torgerson and the other cases that appellant cites is someone was trying to raise an argument at the Supreme Court they hadn't raised at the Court of Appeals, and clearly you can't do that. It doesn't matter whether it was raised at the district court if you could have properly raised the Court of Appeals, but you can't come up with new arguments at the Supreme Court for the first time if they weren't raised before this court. That's what happened in Torgerson. And there's a number of cases that say that. I mean, partially it's because you have to PFR on what you want the Supreme Court to hear. And if you didn't raise an issue in the PFR because you didn't raise it at the Court of Appeals and you think of it later at the Supreme Court, it's too late. So the Robinson decision just cites Torgerson, which is a case at the Supreme Court where it wasn't in the PFR, and it also cites Roby versus State, but that's a case where an appellant is trying to raise a new argument for the first time in appeal.
Post-conviction petitioner.
Right. And you can't do that under Gruning because you're changing the result below. Here, we're just arguing to affirm the result below on different grounds. Gruning clearly says you can do that. Gruning is binding on this court.
So, and Gruning applies to this kind of an issue. I mean, an issue of an exception to the exclusionary rule. In other words, whether that should apply. Gruning reaches that argument in your view?
Yes, Gruning is very broad. Gruning just says you can make new legal arguments on appeal if you're the respondent at the Court of Appeals. If you're the respondent. So you're not changing the end result below, and if the facts support it. Now, if we need new facts, then we can't do it. But if it's a purely legal argument like here, I'm not aware of any case law that limits Gruning to only certain kinds of legal arguments.
What do we do with Douglas? Douglas, the Douglas opinion of this court, which... Okay, I'll take that back. Preservation wasn't an issue.
Want to comment on Douglas, because Douglas was a state's appeal. So... Of course, the good faith issue had been raised because the state was appealing from the denial of that. In this case, if Judge Van Hahn had said, nope, I think under Torgerson you lose, the state could have done a motion for reconsideration and raised the good faith issue. So you don't have to raise good faith every time theoretically a judge might reject your argument and want to go to that. As long as you raise it before the district court, maybe in a motion for reconsideration, if you're going to be the appellant, then you can raise it on appeal like in Douglas. But here, the state won below. It had no reason to try and raise good faith after it had already won. And there's no prejudice to the appellant because he's not claiming we need additional facts to analyze good faith here. So Gruning just fits squarely in this. And again, appellant can PFR and ask the Supreme Court to limit Gruning, but Gruning is binding on this court.
Dawson, it's not in your brief. Where do you get Dawson?
It is. Dawson is cited in one of the briefs. I can't remember if it's cited in mine or his.
I see it in the reply brief. It's non-precedential?
Right. Okay. Appellant's relying on a number of non-precedential decisions. I'm relying on Askaruth and Torgerson, which says you can consider odor and makes clear that it's important that there wasn't drug paraphernalia in that case. I'm relying on Gruning, and to the extent I'm relying on unpublished decisions or non-precedential, I think Chavez-Aguilar is persuasive, case I cited the other day in the supplemental authority letter.
To clarify, and I apologize if I missed this, does Dawson rely on Gruning? Does Dawson rely on Gruning?
Dawson, I think Dawson is a case that doesn't involve good faith. I think they're relying on.
I'm sorry. I thought you mentioned Dawson.
I may have said Dawson when I meant Douglas. I get the two D cases. I might have confused. I'm relying on Douglas for how good faith applies here, and then he's saying Douglas doesn't apply because of not raising it below. Dawson I mentioned at the very beginning of my argument because Dawson's a case where the court found the seizure was invalid based on order for marijuana. But in this case, there is no argument about the stop or seizure. It's what happens after that. So Dawson is inapplicable here because Dawson, an officer, approached an already stopped car and then seized the person based on the smell of marijuana. Here the seizure is based on the speeding. A couple other points I wanted to make just looking over my notes from the oral argument. There's been a lot of talk about whether the marijuana was burnt or unburnt. I think it's actually better for us if it's unburnt, because if it's burnt, it's gone. If it's unburnt marijuana, it's more likely it's in the car. And again, even if marijuana is decriminalized or legal, it's still illegal to transport it without it being sealed up and away from the driver, and it's illegal to have more than a very small amount of marijuana in a car. So it's different than just sitting on a park bench and smelling marijuana on somebody. The fact that it's in a car, the fact that he's under 21, he's 19, makes a big difference here. The Austin and Robinson non-precedential decisions that appellant relies on heavily in the brief and today, neither of them involved a misperception of speeding. Neither of them involved drug paraphernalia. They're just different facts. And in terms of the objective test, there was talk here about, whether there is an objective basis for whether he was using marijuana. But it's not just using, it's also possessing. So we just need an objective basis for there to be probable cause that you're going to find evidence in the car that he's been using marijuana while driving, or just that he's possessing in the car more than a small amount of marijuana. And again, probable cause doesn't mean you eliminate all their possible explanations. Final quick point, appellant points on his brief that some of these crimes are only gross misdemeanors and they shouldn't support probable cause. Petty misdemeanors don't support probable cause. No case says gross misdemeanors, which are crimes, don't support probable cause. And I apologize for going over by a few seconds. Unless this court has additional questions, I simply ask that you affirm.
Thank you. Rebuttal argument?
Yes, Your Honor. We just want to make a few points about what was just stated in respondent's argument, and then we will conclude our time with you all today. Specifically, I want to start with this conversation around misperception of speed, and I want to point to the fact that respondent cites the case ARDS for the proposition that a misperception of speed indicates impairment to a certain degree. And I think that this case is very distinguishable in the sense that it's specifically talking about alcohol, and there's no knowledge that I have around some of this case law that says that misperception of speed as it relates to alcohol is the same as it would be for marijuana to show that there is an impairment here. And so I think that that case is clearly distinguishable under this court's precedent, and I don't think that it's applicable here. Specifically, I would also point to Robinson, where there's a lot of talk, and respondent talks about how Mr. Carlson was going 30% over the speed limit and how that is significant, and that shows impairment in and of itself. But I would point to the fact that in Robinson specifically, the defendant there was going 68 in a 55, which is also significant. And if you did the math on that, it's close to 30% as well. Yet this court didn't find that that was an impairment under the law. Second, I want to address Schisning was discussed, and that was cited in Torgerson, and it related specifically in contrast to Burbeck, which was a part of its reasoning as to why the odor of alcohol might work for someone who is 18 years old versus someone who is 21 years old. And I would point to the fact that Schisning, I'm going to mess that up a few more times, I'm sure, but Schisning was, in that case, an 18-year-old is never able to possess alcohol. A 19-year-old and someone who's 18 could certainly possess marijuana if they're a part of the medical cannabis registry program. And I think that that is an important distinction here as to why there's not only not probable cause, but also why there's not reasonable articulable suspicion of a crime. And certainly the officer could have looked at more objective facts in this particular case in order to make that determination. But by saying that the officer identified one thing and that there's other things in the record seeks to swallow the rule that an officer must be able to point to specific facts that there is an objective reason for going into the vehicle. And third, going into specifically around eliminating other innocent and good reasons as to why a person might not be using something in a criminally illegal manner. Respondent uses this as a reason why this court should affirm the district court's decision that there was other facts available to the district court. And we would point to the fact that in Torgerson, specifically in footnote 9, they cite a study out of the city of Philadelphia how the odor of marijuana was not indicative that there was a crime occurring, and it only happened in 1 of 10 cases where contraband was actually found in the vehicle. And we would say that that same reasoning should apply here as to why it's not enough to support reasonable articulable suspicion or probable cause, because the odor of marijuana, even if you factor in such things as Mr. Carlson's age as well as the CBD pen, those threadbare facts do not get state across the finish line. Again, it's the state's burden to prove that the officer had probable cause in this situation. It doesn't get the state to that finish line here. And that's a really important piece that we don't want the court to lose sight of here. And finally, I just want to discuss specifically how the good faith exception applies or does not apply in this particular case. They're discussing Grunig and talking about how Grunig should apply, and it's broad enough to reach this particular case. But if that were the case, then it would have reached the case in Robinson as well. If that were the case, it would have reached Torgerson as well. And if it was that broad, then certainly the court would have applied it in that situation. And we pointed this out in the last footnote of our reply brief, but the state in Robinson actually did try to apply the Lindquist exception at its argument in the Court of Appeals, and granted there might be a different procedural background as to why Grunig might apply versus what happened in Robinson, but we would say that the Lindquist exception shouldn't apply here because the district court actually considered whether or not Torgerson should apply. The district court saw letter briefs as to why Torgerson should or should not apply, and so it's factually different than those other cases as to whenever a new precedent has come up and the district court didn't have an opportunity to consider it, that's whenever a good faith or alternative argument should apply here.
Grunig doesn't talk about new precedent. It just talks about a different basis to affirm without introducing new facts into the equation.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But we would also point to the facts that if that was true, then why didn't it apply in Robinson?
But, I mean, your opposing counsel's argument is that Robinson, the court just got that wrong. There are a lot of cases where the Supreme Court has applied Grunig in situations where it's affirming on a different basis, but there's no new facts.
That's certainly correct, Your Honor. We understand that the reach of Grunig can be far and wide into those cases, but we reject the premise that it should apply here in the sense that Robinson is the most directly on point case that is factually similar to what Mr. Carlson is arguing, but is also factually similar to why it was affirmed in Douglas specifically, which the respondent cites as reasons that this court must affirm on alternative grounds. And I see that my time is expired, so I simply ask that this court reverse Mr. Carlson's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.